It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Militants attack Kabul airport. Israel and Hamas agree to temporary ceasefire in Gaza. I'm Bill Michaels, reporting from Washington. Afghan officials say militants have exchanged gunfire with Afghan troops in an early morning attack at the Kabul airport. Afghan military officials said the gunmen started firing guns and rockets toward the airport from nearby buildings. Kabul police say the airport is undamaged. Planes have been diverted to other airports. NATO has a major operational base at the airport. Reuters reports that officials say they are aware of the violence but do not have any details. Israel and Hamas militants have agreed to a United Nations request for a temporary ceasefire in Gaza today. The truce will last 5 hours to give Palestinian civilians a chance to restock supplies, repair damaged buildings, and get medical care. But Israel warns it will react if militants fire rockets during the truce. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair.
This initiative is right. It has huge international support. The whole of the international community is behind it. And it is an initiative designed to alleviate the suffering of the people, particularly recognizing the large numbers of people that have died in these previous days in Gaza.
Palestinian officials say the death toll since Israel began its offensive last week rose to 213 Wednesday. 4 children were killed by an Israeli airstrike while playing on a beach near Gaza City. Television cameras captured the scene as the shells hit the beach and the youngsters tried to run away. Israeli officials call the deaths tragic and say they are investigating, but they say Hamas militants deliberately fire rockets from areas crowded with civilians, using them as human shields. They accuse Hamas of war crimes. You can follow the latest developments at voanews.com. U.S. President Barack Obama has announced new economic sanctions on Russian banks and energy companies for Moscow's support of the pro-Russian separatist rebellion in Ukraine.
These sanctions are significant, but they are also targeted, designed to have the maximum impact on Russia while limiting any spillover effects on American companies or those of our allies.
Mr. Obama, speaking Wednesday at the White House, said he has repeatedly urged Moscow to take key steps to ease the crisis and that Russia so far has failed to meet any of the U.S. recommendations.
We have emphasized our preference to resolve this issue diplomatically, but that we have to see concrete actions and not just words, that Russia, in fact, is committed to trying to end this conflict along the Russia-Ukraine border. So far, Russia has failed to take any of the steps that I mentioned.
You can read more about this story at voanews.com. The U.S. and Britain say they have joined other nations in voicing complaints over North Korea's recent string of missile launches, accusing Pyongyang of endangering international aviation. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki confirmed that the U.S. joined other nations in co-signing a letter last week to the International Civil Aviation Organization. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for Britain's Foreign Office told VOA that London is worried about the North's lack of proper prior identification or notification of the launches. President Obama says it has not yet been determined if nuclear talks with Iran will be extended beyond Sunday's deadline for a deal. Mr. Obama said Wednesday that real progress has been made, but there are still significant gaps as the deadline approaches. Pakistani officials say as many as 4 U.S. drone strikes have killed at least 15 people in the country's northwest tribal region. And representatives of Mali's government and ethnic Tuareg separatists have begun peace talks in neighboring Algeria. The talks on Wednesday are aimed at drawing a roadmap for negotiations leading to a final peace agreement. And ink prints of the late Nelson Mandela's hands and photos of the anti-apartheid icon with former pop star Michael Jackson are among the items that go on sale today in Johannesburg. Officials at the Stephen Wise Auction Company say more than 200 lots linked to Mr. Mandela will be up for bid. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's president will meet parents of kidnapped schoolgirls.
The president is president of Nigeria. You know, he will visit Chibok, he will visit anywhere else. There are so many things going on in Nigeria. The president has to have all that in view.
Doyin Okupe is Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan's senior assistant on public affairs. South Africans prepare to celebrate a bittersweet 95th birthday for Nelson Mandela. We'll tell you why the use of contraceptives is on the decline in Zimbabwe, and South Sudan takes delivery of new weapons from China.
The SPLA is the implementer of the security policies of the government of South Sudan. Therefore, the government of South Sudan is trying to equip the army with weapons that are purchased by the government.
Colonel Philip Aguo is South Sudan's military spokesman. Researchers say they have found a weakness in the malaria parasite. And the United Nations says digital surveillance is becoming a dangerous habit. Those stories plus Mark Omar, sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan plans to meet parents of the abducted schoolgirls as well as elders of the Chibok community. Doyin Okupe, the president's senior special assistant on public affairs, says the meetings will take place next week following an official invitation from the president. Mr. Jonathan pledged to meet with the parents following a recent meeting with Pakistani rights activist Malala Yousafzai. But the proposed meeting never happened. In this interview with reporter Peter Clotty, Okupe blamed leaders of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign for the meeting not taking place.
The president has actually formally now invited them to meet with him, you know, on Tuesday, and we are expecting that meeting to hold. The indication from the parents and their leaders in Abuja was that they were not really fully representative, those of them who came to Abuja, and that if the president will agree, they are ready to mobilize themselves and come and meet the president. And the president also, again, acceded to that and wrote them officially, and they have confirmed today that they have received the letter and they will honor the invitation.
We had reports that the parents who were supposed to meet President Jonathan all of a sudden pulled out of the meeting. What can you tell me about this?
When the idea was mooted by Malala, and the president acceded his, you know, to the request by Malala that he should meet those parents, 12 of them, and five girls who are in Abuja, it was a very welcome development by the parents, the girls, and the leaders of their communities in Abuja. But it is the leadership of the Bring Back Our Girls organization who, from time immemorial, we have always known that they had, you know, major political reasons for doing what they were doing. I mean, they were heavily sponsored and had very serious partnership with APC. All right, and that everything they're doing is to embarrass the government and, you know, is pointedly aimed at 2015. They were the people who insisted, even despite Malala's persuasive efforts and those of her parents and members of her delegation, these people refused and, you know, they were adamant and they did not allow the meeting to take place.
So are you saying that this campaign undermined the planned meeting between the president and the parents of the abducted girls?
I'm telling you categorically that that is what happened. Malala herself did everything. She nearly missed her flight. Government officials had to prevail on the pilots to please allow Malala to conclude the arrangement she was making to ensure that the planned visit was not botched.
Is there a possibility that a president will visit Chibok? Because some people have criticized him for not going there.
The president is president of Nigeria. You know, he will visit Chibok, he will visit anywhere else. There are so many things going on in Nigeria. Since Chibok event, over 2,000, 3,000 people have also been killed by Boko Haram. You understand? We have got victims, we have got people in hospitals, we've got people who have died. You know, recently, Abuja was bombed. The president has to have all that in view. So it's not just Chibok. We still have the problem of Boko Haram to contend with. The important thing for us now is to ensure that the girls are delivered back and safe to their parents.
Doyin Okupe is Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan's senior special assistant on public affairs. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. The spokesman for South Sudan's military says the army, with the constitutional responsibility to protect the country, has the right to arm itself. This comes as reports say South Sudan has taken delivery of Chinese arms valued at $14.5 million. Colonel Philip Agua denies the acquisition of new weapons leaves an impression that Juba is not interested in a peaceful end to the seven-month-long civil war. Colonel Agua tells me that the arms were purchased in 2012 as part of a continuing effort to professionalize the army.
The SPLA is the implementer of the security policies of the government of South Sudan. And South Sudan, as a new nation, the army is undergoing a process of transformation which required training, equipment, and reorganizations that started since the 2005 after the signing of the peace agreement between the North and the South. Therefore, the government of South Sudan is trying to equip the army with weapons that are purchased by the government.
Here is the impression that this new armed delivery is presenting. Your government is in the midst of a civil war, and people are saying by you ordering or taking delivery of new weapons that your military, your government, is not probably ready to let the civil war end.
I don't think that the equipment are the one responsible of violence. The violence started in South Sudan after the rebellions of Riek Machar, who agitated some members of the army and the police. Now, this rebellion has to be brought to an end through a political process. We believe that the ongoing process of IGAD should be responsible of achieving peace agreement between the two parties. And we believe that the army will implement an agreement that will be reached in Addis Ababa.
Colonel, what can you tell us who is responsible for the recent violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement because of the recent clashes?
Riek Machar is responsible. He has stated that he is not in control of some of his forces, and this is apparent in Unity State, where Major General Peter Gadet has disregarded the ceasefire, and in Upper Nile, where Major General Garuzgat Quad of Riek Machar have openly stated that they are not implementing an agreement reached in Addis Ababa.
Your government is blaming the rebels led by former Vice President Riek Machar of being responsible for the peace talks not moving. I think one of the demands that the rebels have made is that Ugandan troops that are in your country should withdraw. Is your government willing to let that happen?
Bilateral relations between the countries are by international law allowed. And the government of South Sudan, as a sovereign government, has the right to sign any deal with any country in terms of security. However, the presence of Ugandan forces in South Sudan, for us, is not an obstacle to the achievement of peace in South Sudan. That is a scapegoat from the side of Riek Machar, because they have a lot of demands that they have been demanding from time to time.
Colonel Philip Agua is the spokesman for South Sudan's military. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. For many South Africans, this year's celebration of Nelson Mandela's birthday, July 18th, will be a bittersweet one because Mandela died last year at the age of 95. But some say his influence still looms large in South Africa, and they will honor him on his birthday tomorrow, Friday. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Friday will be the first Mandela Day to happen without its namesake. Former South African President Nelson Mandela died in December after years of declining health. Mr. Mandela went to prison for 27 years for his opposition to the racist apartheid regime. He emerged in 1990 and was elected South Africa's first black president in the nation's first democratic all-race elections. Many South Africans call him Tata, or Father, as he is widely considered the father of today's inclusive rainbow nation. In Johannesburg, many say they plan to celebrate his life and honor his memory by volunteering. Many South Africans say they support a growing initiative to do charitable work for 67 minutes. As the Nelson Mandela Foundation says, that's 1 minute for every year Mr. Mandela gave to his struggle for equality. South African President Jacob Zuma has also announced a nationwide effort called Operation Cleanup for Madiba. Madiba is Mr. Mandela's clan name and is often used as a sign of respect and love. In Johannesburg, college student Mbalenhle Mankai summed up many South Africans' mixed feelings about this year's celebration.
I'm very excited, although I do wish that he was still alive, you know, considering all that he's done for this country and the way he's just changed the way we do things and everything. This Mandela Day, I am going to be working at a charity for some children who are busy while they kind of suffer in life, and I just feel it's within my right, considering all that I have and how blessed I am, to go and to play my part in those children's lives. Yes.
Samson Sivada, who is a professional butler, says he has no definite plans for Mandela Day, but that he will find a way to remember Mr. Mandela and serve in his honor.
Mandela, I would say, is an icon to so many people in the whole world, and we have to be proud, as we as South Africa, to have a man of his caliber. Though he is late now, but they say we have to lead with example. It's the greatest example in a human being's life, definitely.
Businesses are also honoring the day, many with large corporate donations, free events, and charitable initiatives. On a smaller scale, entrepreneur Henry Koch, who runs a trendy restaurant and bar in Johannesburg, says his bar will earmark a portion of every drink sale on the day for Mr. Mandela's children's charity.
It's just about giving something back. Sometimes people don't have time to literally go out and do something for 67 minutes, but I feel like every small donation to that children's home helps. So hopefully we can make a couple of thousand rand and donate it to the children's home, and that can help a child out for a month or two or whatever.
Mandela Day is Friday, and while the great statesman is no longer here, his spirit shines bright over his beloved Rainbow Nation. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 17th. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The United Nations Population Fund has released statistics that show the use of contraceptives in Zimbabwe is on the decline. As Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Harare, the development seems to be an effect of the country's ailing economy.
The research, which was conducted by Features Group International for the UN Population Fund and the government of Zimbabwe, found that thousands of women were getting pregnant each year because they could not afford proper birth control methods. Dr. James Gribble from Features Group International says the contraceptives they use are not the ones they need.
I think the data point out that there are a lot of women, 60%, who really don't want to get pregnant again, but aren't using long-acting methods. They're using oral contraceptives. It's kind of a mismatch. They're using a short-acting method when, in fact, they have a long-term interest in not getting pregnant again.
A nurse at a government hospital in Harare, who asked not to be identified, said the high cost of birth control forces adolescents in Zimbabwe to resort to the black market.
They use in the tertiary institutions or in the streets, they are accessing unregistered family planning commodities. We don't have those statistics. So the unmet need is still there, but we need to know what they are getting from the streets or from other unregistered, so that when we devise our models of delivery, we will address the issue, which means we are going to go where they are.
Official figures say Zimbabwe's contraceptive prevalence rate, the rate at which contraceptives are effectively used, is at 59%. Several international aid groups and governments, including the United States, are funding activities that seek to push that rate higher and to expand access to condoms and other birth control devices. Opposition legislator Ruth Labode, who is a medical doctor, says that making contraceptives less expensive would bring down the country's high rate of deaths during childbirth.
Zimbabweans know. Nobody needs to tell them that they need to use family planning. The economic situation demands that we actually space our children. So I believe we can meet the Millennium Development Goal for a child mortality reduction by using family planning.
A separate report was published Wednesday by the UNAIDS on global progress in fighting HIV. The report says that despite a strong response by Zimbabwe's government, the country is one of the 15 countries accounting for 75% of new HIV infections globally. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Researchers say they have found a weakness in the malaria parasite that could lead to new drugs to block infection. The mosquito-borne disease kills more than 600,000 people every year, most of them in sub-Saharan Africa, and many of them children. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
Josh Beck is the first author of the study that appears in the July 16th edition of the journal Nature.
When the parasite infects a human, it lives not just in your body, but actually inside of red blood cells. And within the red blood cell, it's able to grow, and all the problems that you get when you have malaria are a result of that growth in the red blood cell.
The World Health Organization says there are five parasite species that cause malaria in humans. Plasmodium falciparum is the most deadly. Beck says it does not just invade the cell, it makes major renovations to its new home.
Within the red blood cell, the parasite lives inside of a little membrane compartment that's like a little home for it. And to turn the red blood cell into a proper home for itself, it makes all these different proteins that it sends out into the red blood cell that cause it to be modified in a variety of ways, structurally and metabolically. And these cause some of the disease symptoms that are associated with malaria.
Beck is a postdoctoral research scholar at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He says researchers have known about the parasite proteins for some time, but they were not sure how the hundreds of different proteins actually left the parasite and entered the red blood cell. So they focused on a protein called HSP-101 and found some answers. The proteins pass through a single pore in the parasite's compartment.
What we found is that it looks like it's a bottleneck right there. Everything from all these diverse pathways funnels into this one specific pore.
A potential roadblock, if you will.
It is exciting because it suggests that this process could be broadly inhibited by targeting this one specific piece of parasite machinery.
In lab experiments, when researchers blocked that pore, the parasite stopped growing and eventually died. They describe it as entombing the parasite. To make that happen in infected people, however, will take a lot more work. New malaria drugs will be needed. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A new United Nations report warns that mass digital surveillance is posing a threat to people's right to privacy and is becoming a dangerous habit rather than an exceptional measure. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, whose office produced the report, is calling for stronger safeguards against this mass surveillance to protect against violations of human rights. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report warns digital snooping is increasing and occurring in countries all over the world. It says the incidence may be greater in governments equipped with better technology, but it fears oversight of digital surveillance programs in most countries is inadequate and therefore open to abuse. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay says states must show their surveillance programs are being used for legitimate law enforcement or intelligence purposes. She says it is up to the government officials to prove these programs do not arbitrarily or unlawfully gather information on people. She tells VOA states have an obligation to balance their need for security with their need to protect people's right to privacy.
I, of course, support the efforts made in the United States and other countries to safeguard all of us from acts of terrorism. After all, states have an obligation to protect all their citizens against the harm of terrorism. On the other hand, what are the checks and balances? What kind of safeguards should be in place? And how should states be encouraged to update their laws and so on to keep pace with these developments?
The report notes strong evidence of governments' growing reliance on the private sector to conduct and facilitate digital surveillance. Pillay says she is disturbed by the methods governments are using to collect metadata on their own citizens as well as on foreigners.
Some governments have reportedly threatened to ban services of telecommunications companies unless given direct access to communication traffic. Others have tapped fiber optic cables for surveillance purposes or required companies systematically to disclose bulk information on customers and employees. Some have used communications surveillance to target political opposition or dissidents.
Pillay warns that companies which supply data to a state in violation of human rights law risk being complicit or involved with human rights abuses. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. South Africans Cornel Fredericks and Wade van Niekerk triumphed at the Spitzen meet in Lausanne, Switzerland on Tuesday night. Fredericks prevailed in the 400-meter hurdles in 49.03 seconds as van Niekerk clocked 20.60 seconds in 200 meters. Clement and Lawrence Kemboi clinched a 1-2 Kenyan podium sweep in 3,000-meter steeplechase as Kenya's Stacey Ndiwa won the women's 5,000 meters. Zambian Kabange Mpopo was runner-up in women's 400 meters, while South African Wenda Nell was third in the women's 400-meter hurdles. Turning to football, Cameroon's Coton Sport held their hosts AC Leopards of the Republic of Congo to a scoreless draw in Dolesi on Tuesday night to hold on to pole position in Group A at the halfway stage of the mini-league contest in the Orange Africa Confederations Cup. Coton Sport have 7 points, AC Leopards has 5, Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa has 2, and Mali's AS Real de Bamako has 1 point. In Group B, Egypt's El Ahly and Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel are tied with 5 points each. However, El Ahly edge Etoile du Sahel on goal difference. Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports are third with 3 points, while Zambia's Nkana has 1 point. Meanwhile, Botswana host Guinea-Bissau in Gaborone, Uganda welcome Mauritania in Kampala, as Sierra Leone engage Seychelles in Freetown in the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers on Saturday. On Sunday, Lesotho play Kenya in Maseru, Benin host Malawi in Cotonou, as the Republic of Congo engage Rwanda in Point Noir, and Tanzania face Mozambique in Dar es Salaam. Finally, Ethiopia play Gabon as South Sudan welcome Ghana, and Cameroon play Burkina Faso in Orange Africa Under-17 Championship qualifiers on Saturday. On Sunday, the Democratic Republic of Congo engage Nigeria, Togo face Senegal, Guinea welcome Morocco as Libya play Ivory Coast. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Thursday morning, July 17th.
Permit me to ask this question. Why should Africans be so addicted to all negative devices such as war, witchcraft, diseases, corruption, starvation, inflation, political instability, as well as nepotism, tribalism, and terrorism? It is high time African leaders should seek moral advice from Western leaders, and God shall visit the continent morally. I am Prince John Michel Obaniku in Obodo Ranch Resort, Cross Valley, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A new survey indicates that the number of people killed during the height of the Central African Republic conflict has been underestimated. And that's it for this Thursday, July 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stradak, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington. Remember, Africa, no one is richer than a person who has a peace of mind.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from The Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the Internet at www.voaafrica.com.